I believe we are on page 386.
It's the paragraph beginning. But we see further that it is not solely and ultimately.
That's what Matteo, I believe, read last time to finish. Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And we should read it again, but we can start from that point. So, in this chapter, the eternal and the individual, so far Sri Aurobindo has been looking at these two categories. He begins by looking at the individual and what is the individual, and does the individual have anything greater than what we experience as the ego life? And then he talks about the fact that something else is putting forward a self for the interactions with the world. And this self that is being put forward is made up of the constituents of our nature. And it depends on two things. On the one hand, on something which is individualizing, something hidden, which is individualizing, and the cosmos itself, in relation to which it is individualizing, with the contents of which it is individualizing. And so last time we also discussed this from the viewpoint of the fact that our experience of the self, if we look at it rationally, as he's pointing out, we take ourselves to be a finite being, a finite self that is pitted against the cosmos. And we are trying to survive in this situation, and we do so by adapting to our environment and trying to master our environment. And then on the other hand, we also try to maximize our power of survival by developing various kinds of mechanisms, defense mechanisms and advantage mechanisms. And they include forms of competition and forms of cooperation. We form collectives. We form smaller collectives and larger collectives. And these collectives are in many cases at odds with other larger collectives and with the cosmos. On the one hand, the whole history of humanity can be seen as an attempt to maximize our power of individual and collective survival. In pre-modern times, in a variety of ways, but in modern times, mainly through attempting to understand our place in the cosmos and the cosmos itself, so that we may have mastery over it, we may be able to become its master. But something eludes us, and then there is another side to it, which is that whatever we call ourselves, though rationally we feel that we are in some sense self-determined, we are individuals in that sense. On the other hand, we are in interaction with the world in unpredictable ways. We feel that we give responses to the cosmos which are not necessarily determined in advance. Even if we determine it in advance, we can never tell how we'll eventually end up responding to our circumstances. So something is in relation, in dynamic relation with the cosmos. And it's constructing our responses as we go along. This sense is with us at some level. Now, if we look at it like that, then the idea of a pre-given ego, which is a finite self, fixed, which we can determine as ourselves, is overcome, and we can see a more mutable type of sort of construction that is always going on. We're constantly trying to adapt. Now, what is it that is doing this adaptation? So whatever is on the surface is a habitual self, a self made up of rules of thumb, heuristics, as we may call it. But what is it that is forming this, constructing this? On the one hand, it is something mysterious that we are not fully able to define, something indefinable within us. And on the other hand, it is the contacts with the cosmos. It is the fact that we mirror the cosmos through the kinds of interactions we have with it, and we respond to that through certain means, adequate or inadequate. And we are constantly trying to increase our adequacy over there. So this process is something that doesn't begin with us. It goes way back into the beginnings of the cosmos itself. And we may say with some modern philosophers that there is a process of individualization that is going on, or rather individuation that is going on. This process of individuation is occurring within the limits of the nature that is available to respond to the cosmos. And it is only at the human level that the boundaries of this individuation process become very much more unpredictable. Where does our individuation end? We are not sure about that. We keep pushing the boundaries. At first we think that we can master the world by understanding it through knowledge. But later we find that even that is not enough. All our knowledge is just piecemeal knowledge, is integrated piecemeal knowledge. And that is not the same as integral knowledge. Integrated piecemeal knowledge remains like a larger whole, one may say. It continues to be a construction. And the wholeness eludes us. Some echo is coming. Okay, anyway. So we find that to arrive at that wholeness again, we have to move towards some other kind of experience. But at the same time, we intuit the fact that we are in relation with the cosmos. This is something which gradually humanity awakens to. This fact that in the individuation process is a process that is making the cosmos individual. It is as if the cosmos itself seeks to become an individual. It is seeking that in all things, but at the level of the human individual, it is pushing the boundaries to a greater extent. It's as if our efforts are much more intimate with that sense of the cosmos. I think we are at that point, and Sri Aurobindo has also introduced in the consideration the attempts of the past to understand the individual in a polar fashion, in a bipolar fashion. In other words, is the individual either doomed to remain separate from the cosmos as a kind of an entity, a monad? Or can it in some way or form dissolve itself into the cosmic being and lose its individuality, lose its separation, but at the same time also lose its individuality? And where we are, he's pointing out that that may not necessarily be the case, that the individual and the cosmic are two realities that are in relation and that are ultimately backgrounded by the same self, a mysterious self of all things, is becoming individual and becoming cosmos at the same time. It is the cosmic self and the individual self in all individuals. So I think that's where we are at this point, and we can move on into that paragraph, unless anybody would like to ask any questions or make any comments. I think maybe we can continue. I think last time Matteo read that paragraph. It's a beautiful paragraph and very beautifully read. I think we should reread that paragraph. And somebody can read it. Keka, would you like to read it?
But we see farther that it is not solely and ultimately the cosmic being into which our individual being enters, but something in which both are unified. As our individualization in the world is a becoming of that self, so is the world too a becoming of that self. The world being includes always the individual being. Therefore, these two becomings, the cosmic and the individual, are always related to each other and in their practical relation mutually dependent. But we find that the individual being also comes in the end to include the world in its consciousness. And since this is not by an abolition of the spiritual individual, but by his coming to his full, large, and perfect self-consciousness, we must suppose that the individual always included the cosmos, and it is only the surface consciousness which by ignorance failed to possess that inclusion because of its self-limitation in ego. But when we speak of the mutual inclusion of the cosmic and the individual, the world in me, I in the world, all in me, I in all. For that is the liberated self-experience. We are evidently traveling beyond the language of the normal reason. That is because the words we have to use were minted by mind and given their values by an intellect bound to the conceptions of physical space and circumstance, and using for the language of a high psychological experience figures drawn from the physical life and the experience of the senses. Um, one second. Let me just repeat. That is because the words we have to use were minted by mind and given their values by an intellect bound to the conceptions of physical space and circumstance. And using for the language of a higher psychological experience figures drawn from the physical life and the experience of the senses. But the plane of consciousness to which the liberated human being arises is not dependent upon the physical world, and the cosmos which we thus include and are included in it in is not the physical cosmos, but the harmonically manifest being of God in certain great rhythms of his conscious force and self-delight. Therefore, this mutual inclusion, therefore this mutual inclusion is spiritual and psychological. It is a translation of the two forms of the many, all and individual, into a unifying spiritual experience. A translation of the eternal unity and the many. For the one is the eternal unity of the many differentiating and undifferentiating itself in the cosmos. This means that cosmos and individual are manifestations of a transcendent self who is indivisible being, although he seems to be divided or distributed. But he is not really divided or distributed, but indivisibly present everywhere. Therefore, all is in each, and each is in all, and all is in God, and God in all. And when the liberated soul comes into union with this transcendent, it has this self-experience of itself and cosmos, which is translated psychologically into a mutual inclusion and a persistent existence of both in a divine union, which is at once a oneness and a fusion and an embrace.
So, this very powerful paragraph, Sri Aurobindo is ultimately bringing these terms together. And we have to realize that he's actually trying to express in the languages of in the language of the mind that which is way beyond the language of the mind. So it's almost like describing a different kind of topology, a topology which uses a different dimensional mathematics almost, or geometry. So here he's talking about, on the one hand, something which is indivisible, one and indivisible, and on the other hand, that has divided itself in appearance. And this self-division of the many, of the infinite possibilities of the one, this infinity of the one, is occurring in two ways. One is the inclusion of the many as the all, and the other is the differentiation of the one as the many individuals in this all. So these two forms of the many, which are self-appearances of the one, are in relation with each other. At the same time, they are the same, they are one, they are the transcendent that has become the all and the many, the each. So we have to see that what Sri Aurobindo is talking about is this individuation process that is occurring in the cosmos trying to become an individual. And it's occurring in the individual trying to become cosmic. So it's these two ways in which it is proceeding. The cosmos trying to become individual is the evolution of nature. It's what Sri Aurobindo has called elsewhere nature's yoga. The yoga of Prakriti. The individual trying to become cosmic is the individual's yoga, the yoga of the Purusha. So we have these two processes. The nature's yoga is causing the evolution of forms of Prakriti that are more and more adequate to the experience of the cosmos. And the evolution of the individual is something which is becoming in the individual more and more conscious of itself as the cosmos. Now, we may say in a way that, as he is pointing out, at all times the cosmos is the one being and each individual is the one being, because the one being has never ceased from being the one being. It has remained forever inviolate as the indivisible one. So the individual always had something in it that made it possible for it to experience itself as cosmos. Now this is something which we can take back not only at the individual human level, but at any individual level. We could say that the worm, the bird, the plant, the mammal, at some level of its essential being, can experience its oneness with the cosmos. This is its Purusha experience. The same for the human being. The human being, at any point in human history, could plunge within and experience its oneness with the cosmos. Because the cosmos, the cosmic self, lives in each of us. We are part of the cosmos, and yet the entire cosmos lives in each of us. However, at the human level, because of the instruments of Prakriti that have been developed, our access to this experience is a more waking experience. It contains more features of a possessed or realized oneness. It is not merely in a state of trance or deep sleep that we know that oneness. But we can gradually increase our waking sense of that oneness. We see the history of humanity in a way engaging with that. So for all time we can, as before, even now, come into contact with what some philosophers have called the ever-present origin. This is a term which forms the title of the great magnum opus of the philosopher Jean Gebser, the ever-present origin. It is always present. Irrespective of our place in history, we can connect with it, we can know it to be our true self. But at the same time, our access to it through nature is something which changes over time. At a certain point, it is religious because we access it mythically. We access it in a sense in terms of a variety of symbols that we see it or mirror it through. We see the correspondences in the cosmos and we give names to these beings behind these correspondences. And thereby we come into contact with the cosmos. Now, in our own times, we have entered into a new kind of relationship with the cosmos. And this relationship is often not fully understood, though some philosophers have talked about it. This relationship has been mediated through technology. We find even in this very experience that we are having together a certain kind of openness to the whole universe as being present in our mind space. A non-local universe is present in our everyday lives. We can contact places in the globe that are far away from us in time and space. This lends a certain quality to our experience. We may be unconscious of this change of quality, yet it does mean a certain kind of qualitative change in our everyday experience. We also find that our interdependence has made us physically much more, you know, sort of in contact with the cosmos. Our access to media and our inundation by media is bringing the cosmos to our senses all the time, and bringing the cosmos to our material lives all the time. So in a sense, we may say, in a new way, humanity today is in relationship with the cosmos in a more materialized sense than ever before. It is as if that oneness that we could at any time always experience in rare states of meditation or consciousness is available or becoming available to us as a quality of our waking consciousness, of the Jagrat itself. And that kind of quality of consciousness is something that we have to become more aware of. The way to become aware of that is to connect our internal sense of that cosmic oneness, of the cosmic existence, with our external sense, which is really much more amplified today than ever before. So, in a sense, this paragraph that he's talking about ends by speaking about the complexity of our oneness with the cosmos. This complexity is stated in three terms. On the one hand, there is a oneness. In other words, that is the ever-present origin. That is the indivisible one, the only one there is, the one into which we may merge, and which we then experience to be the same self that has become the many in their individual forms, as well as the many that is the entirety of the cosmos. That is the essential union, the essential oneness. Then he talks about a fusion. A fusion is the realization that the cosmos lives in us and we live in the cosmos, as he says. We fuse with the cosmic self. We become the cosmic self. The cosmic self at some level is experienced by us internally and in the expansion of our personal consciousness, as the being that contains all the entities of the cosmos. It is the cosmic consciousness that we experience. And the third term is the embrace. The embrace implies individual relationship. In the embrace, the individual and the cosmos are voluntarily related as distinct entities that have entered into intimate relationship and have come to know their oneness. So these three forms of the relationship between the individual and the cosmos form the totality of the complex oneness in which we are placed in the process of the individuation of the cosmos and the cosmicization of the individual. This is really the goal towards which the evolution moves. And Sri Aurobindo spells it out in this grand paragraph by talking about the true relationship between the individual and the cosmos. Not the ego, but the true individual, and not a kind of ecological system as the cosmos, but the cosmic Purusha. It is not in the dissolution of the self, but in the unification of the self through these three forms that constitutes the waking realization of the fulfillment of the process of individuation and cosmicization that is going on.
Devashish?
Yes, Owen.
Hi. It seems to me that becoming more aware of the Purusha, which is inside of us and in cosmos, I think there are perhaps different levels of the Purusha, but becoming aware of that Purusha is affected by taking on the witness consciousness and really trying to become the observer and the witness of that within us. That's one point I wanted to bring up. And talking about the oneness between Purusha and within us, the cosmos and the individual, and that element of the one, which is within all of us, it reminded me of this story of an old priest who was overseeing a monastery, and they had prepared a great meal, the monks and the priest, of course, was the last to be served, and there was one person who hadn't gotten any food, and so the priest took his meal and he gave it to the other, and some of the monks were clearly disturbed that he wasn't going to get to eat any of this food that they had all been preparing for him. And so he said, "Do not worry, my brothers. I will enjoy this food in all my many selves." So I was reminded of that story. But I wanted to bring up that witness consciousness as a way to look at Purusha and get people's thoughts on that. And maybe I might have something to say later, but I'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah. So Owen, now this question of the Purusha, you know, the Purusha, there is one Purusha. So You're quite right. You began by talking about many levels of the Purusha. I think that was that's very true. Here particularly we are talking about three levels of the Purusha. There is only one Purusha. That Purusha is the cosmic, not the cosmic, but the transcendental Purusha. The being, the only being there is. We can give it the name Brahman. We can call it Purushottama, the Supreme Purusha. Now, that same Supreme Purusha is sort of self-manifest in a certain appearance as the cosmic Purusha. So it is as if to manifest itself, it takes a certain kind of arrangement or disposition of its own infinity, and that becomes the cosmos. And within this cosmos, that same Purusha is again self-manifest as all the entities of the cosmos. So each of these entities is this person. This one person there is, the indivisible person. This same person is the cosmos. This same person is every entity in the cosmos, every individual. So at the individual level, it is the root of the one. The one person there is that has appeared as these three kinds of, or that what that has appeared as the two kinds of its own self-manifestation, the orders of its infinity, two orders of its own infinity. Now, what you're talking about as the witness self, as the Purusha, is another kind of Purusha. The Purusha in the individual is again divided into three Purushas. The mental Purusha, the vital Purusha, and the physical Purusha. But its true root is as what has been called the psychic being. And even behind that, the psychic entity. It is the soul. It is the essence of the one in the many. And what Sri Aurobindo is talking about here is not primarily the witness self. He's talking about accessing the oneness of the individual, the cosmos, and the transcendent through that soul, through that Purusha, through the one that only exists in its self-appearances at the root of every being. So that's where we have to find it. Over there we find that the oneness with the cosmos doesn't erase or eradicate the individual, but shows the infinity of the transcendent in every individual and in the totality of all individuals in relation with each other. It is the infinite one that has entered into a relational cosmos through this process that he's talking about. It could have remained indivisible and could have remained unmanifest, but it can also manifest its infinity through this kind of a disposition of relations, and that is what this is all about.
Devashish?
Yes, Owen.
Can you speak a bit more on how when we are individuating through paying attention to and meditating on this Purusha, this one Purusha, which is within us, how that is individuating the world and the Prakriti or the Maya and the levels of Shakti, the Divine Mother, all the material world and nature, but also how it's affecting other people who or everything that has that Purusha in it. So as we're individuating how that ripples out and affects other people.
Yeah, Owen. So that's a very profound question. And, you know, the answer is it may and it may not. Again, I take your attention back to the notion of the ever-present origin. An individual may experience the cosmic being without having any change in the cosmic being's own prakriti, in the nature of the cosmic being, or in the nature of other individuals. One may have a experience of identity with the cosmic Purusha, but that may not have any effect on anybody else. But it's only when our experience of oneness with the cosmic Purusha also includes some prakritic elements that this oneness becomes extended into the cosmos and the prakriti of the cosmos. So that's where I was saying we have a new way, and you know, Jean Gebser has been talking about the variety of ways through history that we have connected through our prakriti, found doors of entry to the Purusha. You know, and he talks about different types of epochs, the mythic epoch, the magic epoch. He starts with the archaic, then the magic, then the mythic. And then we come to the individual and the rational epoch. Sri Aurobindo also talks about our present epoch as the rational cycle, the rational age.
The archaic to the magic to the mythic, that sounds very much like Ken Wilber's method as well.
Yeah, if Ken Wilber got some of these ideas from people like Jean Gebser and Sri Aurobindo. Ken Wilber is taking from these people. But today we have a new kind of relationship with the cosmos in its prakriti. And this is what I was talking about earlier. Philosophers like Gebser call it the integral structure. He's, again, using a word similar to what Sri Aurobindo uses. Teilhard de Chardin uses the term noosphere. And he's saying that this sense of the cosmic, this more materialized sense of the cosmic, and Teilhard was also conscious of the fact that our technology might be leading us in that direction. And the media philosopher Marshall McLuhan actually took it one step further in saying that the nervous system of the individual has extended itself and become a cosmic nervous system in the cyberspace. See, it's like a cosmic nervous system. It's no longer, it doesn't belong to the individual, but it belongs to the totality of all individuals. And at the same time, it is cosmic. So that is, in a way, an individuation of the cosmos and a cosmicization of the individual. The question is, to what extent do we as individuals experience that? We use it, we are used by it, but how do we experience it? And this was Teilhard's entire thesis, that it's as if we are on the verge of opening a new kind of consciousness, a new kind of nature, a new kind of mind, which is a cosmic mind in the individual, an individualized cosmic mind. He talked about it's just going to take a spark, and suddenly individuals will become aware through their, not through computers, but through their own minds, of the presence of this cosmic mind. And that is a kind of experience of what you're talking about, of the prakriti of the cosmos, into which the experience of the individual may actually have effects that can be generated and have some sort of stabilizing factor or things of that kind. So it's almost as if a new spirituality is open to us. And to what extent can we enter into this kind of experience? This is also part of what the mother is talking about, the new adventure that she's calling people to. It's no longer an adventure of a trance in which we plunge into our deepest parts and experience our oneness with the cosmos. That is also there, and that has always been there. But it's a new kind of experience, an experience of a waking state of the cosmic consciousness.
Mother's last New Year's message of 1973 was, when you are conscious of the whole world at the same time, then you can become conscious of the divine.
Exactly, Matteo. That's one of the most beautiful and profound messages, and that's her last message to humanity. She is giving us that new spirituality that we are talking about right in that message. She's giving us the agenda for the future.
It's kind of a cosmic empathy, if you will, in part.
So a cosmic empathy would be part of it. It would be one door to it, but it would go beyond that. It would be a realized sense of, both as you talked about the witness of the cosmos, as well as the power of the cosmos, the cosmic being that can actually experience the entire cosmos within itself and have power over it.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Yeah, let's read the next paragraph.
John Robert, would you like to read next?
Yes, I'd be happy to. The normal experience of the reason, therefore, is not applicable to these higher truths. In the first place, the ego is the individual only in the ignorance. There is a true individual who is not the ego and still has an eternal relation with all other individuals, which is not egoistic or self-separative, but of which the essential character is practical mutuality founded in essential unity. This mutuality founded in unity is the whole secret of the divine existence in its perfect manifestation. It must be the basis of anything to which we can give the name of a divine life. But secondly, we see that the whole difficulty and confusion into which the normal reason falls is that we are speaking of a higher and illimitable self-experience founded on divine infinities, and yet are applying to it a language formed by this lower and limited experience, which founds itself on finite appearances and the separative definitions by which we try to distinguish and classify the phenomena of the material universe. Thus, we have to use the word individual and speak of the ego and the true individual, just as we speak sometimes of the apparent and the real man. Evidently, all these words, man, apparent, real, individual, true, have to be taken in a very relative sense and with a full awareness of their imperfection and inability to express the things that we mean. By individual, we mean normally something that separates itself from everything else and stands apart, though in reality, there is no such thing anywhere in existence. It is a figment of our mental conceptions, useful and necessary to express a partial and practical truth. But the difficulty is that the mind gets dominated by its words and forgets that the partial and practical truth becomes true truth only by its relation to others, which seem to the reason to contradict it, and that taken by itself, it contains a constant element of falsity. Thus, when we speak of an individual, we mean ordinarily an individualization of mental, vital, physical being, separate from all other beings and capable of unity with them by its very individuality. If we go beyond these three terms of mind, life, and body and speak of the soul or individual self, we still think of an individualized being separate from all others, incapable of unity and inclusive mutuality, capable at most of a spiritual contact and soul sympathy. It is therefore necessary to insist that by the true individual, we mean nothing of the kind, but a conscious power of being of the eternal, always existing by unity, always capable of mutuality. It is that being which by self-knowledge enjoys liberation and immortality.
So Sri Aurobindo returns here to the idea of the difference between our normal experience and the mind's attribution of certain values to our individuality and the truth of things. And this comes from the fact, as he points out, that the indivisible one has entered into the appearance of self-division. In the previous chapter, he talked about the mechanisms by which this happens. But here he's pointing out that this ability of the one to divide itself and stand behind each of its discrete self-divisions as a qualitative discreteness that one may call the soul, is the way by which it can create a world of relations. It is as if it enters into possibilities of itself that it puts forward. And in putting forward these possibilities, it does not lose its soul oneness, but it hides its soul oneness. It makes its oneness latent and fronts it with a limited aspect or configuration or disposition of its own infinity. Now this particular configuration or arrangement is then given Prakritic realizations through degrees of finitude. So from the infinite we move towards things which appear more finite. But even in its most finite discreteness, which is achieved in the medium of matter, yet all its infinity is present there. Its infinity is present as latent potential. So it is that the possibility of individualized infinities that can enter into relation with each other and wonder at each other because they are always infinite is achieved as the ground or basis of a divine life on earth. That's what he means by the mutuality of the one and the true individual. The true individual who is not the ego and still has an eternal relation with all other individuals, which is not egoistic or self-separative, but of which the essential character is practical mutuality, founded in essential unity. This practical mutuality founded on essential unity is a dimension of the undivided one. It's another dimension of its self-existence. It's seeming self-division for the purposes of the play of infinity. At the level of the physical, because it becomes most discreetly separate, we have a physical existence, the physical body, which houses a mind that identifies its individuality with this physical discreteness, and therefore thinks of itself as separate, completely separate from all other entities, physical entities. But as he's pointing out, this is only one way of looking at the individual. This coexists with three other nature ways, or rather two other nature ways, the mental individual, the vital individual, and here the physical individual. This is what I was referring to earlier about the three purushas that are related to the three kinds of media through which the prakriti expresses itself. But behind this is the self-individuation of the indivisible one, and that is the soul. So that's why he's talking over there in that sentence of the soul as something which the mind can still think of as separate from all others, but which actually is one because there is none other than that one Purusha, and yet exists in a certain configuration or dimension of that oneness that allows relations with other discretions of itself. So that sentence is, if we go beyond these three terms of mind, life and body and speak of the soul or individual self, we still think of an individualized being, separate from all others, incapable of unity and inclusive mutuality, capable at most of a spiritual contact and soul sympathy. This is what we were saying about the sympathy with which we can experience others, or the empathy with which we can experience others and the cosmos. But that is only one dimension or one aspect of that embrace that he's talking about, the intimate relation that he's talking about. More essential is the deep oneness, the oneness that is the oneness of the only being there is, and the oneness in power and perception. So that's why he says, it is therefore necessary to insist that by the true individual we mean nothing of the kind, but a conscious power of being of the eternal, always existing by unity, always capable of mutuality. It is that being which by self-knowledge enjoys liberation and immortality. So here he is pointing to the fact of the transition necessary in our sense of self and the results of that transition. If we know the truth of the self, if we know that we are indeed, as individuals, ultimately the only being there is in relation with other configurations of itself, then in that knowledge we experience our eternity. So that is the first level of the immortality and the liberation from the bondage to finitude and limitation. The second level is bringing that knowledge of the eternity into the instruments of the prakriti and bringing it all the way from mind through life into the body, ultimately realizes eternity in the mental, vital, and physical instruments and brings us the immortality of our inner being, the instruments of nature that are made immortal because they know their oneness with the eternal self, that is the true individual.
Devishish, it seems to me that Sri Aurobindo here is riffing or playing off of the principles that he established in the first chapter of this section, the principle of the power of variation and the power of self-immersion or the power of consciousness to immerse in one of these variations in order to create the manifestation, in order for the manifestation to happen. And here he's talking about a particularization or one aspect of that. Would you say that's correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely correct, John Robert. Yeah, one has to remember that or what you're talking about is in just the previous paragraph. I mean, previous chapter, not the first chapter, but in the Purusha Ishvara, Brahman Purusha Ishvara chapter, where he talks about the three operations of Brahman. And exactly, he is extending that idea, and that idea is that the background of this entire book, actually the second book, the way in which those operations become the appearance and why and what we can do about it, what is the purpose of God, one may say, in those operations and how we experience ourselves.
Thank you.
As you can see, in some cases, in some of these paragraphs, Sri Aurobindo is quite explicit about certain things, but much more implicit about certain things. And one has to read between the lines in many cases to really arrive at things that he will expand on later or expand on elsewhere. And that's the reason why some of these things that he's talking about, seem to be so abbreviated. But we touched upon this factor of the Purusha and the three divisions of the Prakriti, which he has introduced here. That's exactly the question that Owen was asking about the Purusha. The Purusha is only the witness in the mental Purusha. There is a vital aspect to the Purusha and a physical aspect to the Purusha. And the true Purusha is none of these. The true Purusha is the soul, is the individuation of the indivisible one as a discrete infinity.
So, Devashish,
yes.
We're talking about these three vehicles of the mind, the emotions, and the physical body. And I mean, this is a very profound psychology, a very profound way of looking at yourself, because trying to see what are the obstacles and looking more particularly at each of these bodies within ourself, and what are the what is the capability for being able to experience this oneness of the Purusha within our emotional body, within our mental body, and within our physical body. And there I go back to that kind of witness element of trying to, that's just how I tend to think of it, in terms of being able to see how, what's happening within those bodies. But anyway, I just wanted to say it seems to be a very, excellent way of kind of looking at those different vehicles and seeing what's arising and inviting and trying to having that aspiration towards that oneness of the Purusha within those bodies.
Yes, undoubtedly. But we have to realize also, I wanted to correct something there, Owen, and that is that the vital Purusha is, or even the vital Prakriti, is not just the emotional body. The body of emotions is one aspect of the vital Prakriti. The other aspect is the aspect of power. Power has its own reality, and power is centered in the vital body. So what we have is the mental Purusha, the mental body, the mental sheath, whose primary power is that of the witness, that can observe and remain impartial, remain free, remain liberated from the rest of the Prakriti. The emotional Purusha experiences others by the power of sympathy and empathy. It can actually feel what somebody else is feeling, by extension of oneness. The Purusha in the realm of power can have effects in the cosmos. It can actually exert its power, and it can experience the play of power in the universe, which is very different from observing. And the physical Purusha can not only experience stillness at the level of the physical, but can also immortalize the physical ultimately. That is the ultimate goal of bringing the Purusha fully into the physical. These are different aspects. They bring different gifts. It is not merely one of witnessing. Each aspect of the Purusha in the different bodies of Prakritis brings a different kind of gift.
Thank you for that clarification. It's coming to be clearer now. Thank you.
I'd like to comment that in considering a Jungian approach to psychology, one would begin with an integration of the shadow. And this integration of the shadow would, it would be not simply an awareness of the oneness of the divine as a wholeness, but simply of, if one is going to elevate oneself, one is also going to endarken oneself and risk the problems of endarkenment. One resolution in spiritual practice is to actually offer the darkness back to the divinity, and so the divinity carries that darkness. That's in order for humankind to have some kind of conscious relationship to the shadow, to the dark side of its own aspirations, without which the unconsciousness leads to catastrophe, according to Jung. So I wanted to offer that question, I mean, because these passages are about a very transcendent sense of self and of a kind of a spiritual transcendent level of awareness, but there's another element which seems to be, in terms of speaking of a psychology of this relationship in some way to the shadow. So I would like to leave that as a suggestion or a question to integrate in this conversation.
So, yes, Justin, indeed, and we'll find chapters in this very part of The Life Divine where he will address that. These are not mutually exclusive. The realization of oneness is not premised on a kind of a set of a negation of the shadow. The shadow exists, but the oneness has also been experienced with or without the shadow. In other words, what he's saying over here is, this is the truth of things. There is an ultimate monism, and the dualism that exists in the world is also true, but that needs to be looked at with respect to this inviolate oneness of things. Now, the inviolate oneness of things is not something that Jung really addressed, but what he's talking about over here is that somewhere in us, we know this. We know that beyond all the darkness, there is just the One. Now, in operating in the world, and particularly with respect to the world of power, understanding, that's exactly what I meant by the Purusha at the three different levels, and the independent world of power. And in that independent world of power, part of the knowledge of the Purusha is the knowledge of the shadow. And that exactly is what transformation through the contact of the Purusha at the vital level can bring us. This is a slightly different approach, but it does not mean that what Jung is saying is wrong. All it means is that there are other ways of getting there.
Could you please explain this part? Totally unfamiliar with this.
Actually, it's interesting because Sri Aurobindo himself acknowledged this notion of the shadow, particularly as Jung describes it, which was brought to his notice. And of all the teachings of Jung, the one that resonated most with Sri Aurobindo was this idea of the shadow. The shadow, from our point of view, could be seen as the world of the hostiles, the world of falsehood that ultimately attaches itself to the individual. Somewhere in the individual prakriti, there is a compromise with the hostile, with this refusal to progress, the refusal of consciousness that warps itself and becomes something which acts counter to the oneness and to the experience of oneness, not only in oneself, but also in one's dealings with others. So this, in fact, he also pointed out, that the higher one goes, the more intense the shadow becomes, and the more its need for transformation. It needs to be integrated and transformed. And in that respect, it is exactly as Justin was saying. But he brings to it other kinds of tools as well, not just a tool of offering it to the divine, which is also part of what he's saying, and he'll make it very clear, but also coming into identity with the divine. There is a way by which the power of the divine can be mobilized, and also a way by which the divine as a transcendent in relation to us can transform us through the offering of the shadow.
So you mean the resistance to having this identity, or I mean this kind of unity that Shobhind is talking about, is the resistance that you are referring to by this shadow?
In a sense, yes. The resistance is not something that is only in us. The resistance is metaphysical. It is metaphysical because the granting of freedom to ignorance implies the existence of the will to remain ignorant. And the will to remain ignorant expresses itself as a falsehood that distorts every attempt towards becoming conscious of the One. And it operates in our life as well as in our relations with the world. It prevents the experience of the One. And this is particularly in the case of the Prakriti. In the case of the Purusha, it does not apply, because the Purusha is always in oneness. But it is the relation between Purusha and Prakriti, and the relation between Prakriti and Prakriti, that is blighted by the shadow.
So the relation between Purusha and Prakriti, I sort of can imagine a between Prakriti and Prakriti. By the way, that the two kinds of falsehood that I guess I'm translating it into the resistance of the cosmic and the individual, cosmic ego or the cosmic cosmos, and the cosmic Prakriti and the individual Prakriti. Or resistance of those two are probably the two kinds of falsehood that you are referring to. And what do you mean by, so that you please confirm. And another is, what do you mean by between Purusha and Prakriti?
So two kinds of falsehood is basically, one is the ignorance at its basis. Yeah, you could say it is cosmic in that sense that the will to remain unconscious offers itself as a cosmic shadow, and that becomes individual in each individual. So we carry that shadow with us. And in fact, we intensify the shadow with every attempt to transcend. In the Prakriti, in the Purusha, there is no attempt to transcend. It is already, in relation or in union with the transcendent. Now, the relation between Purusha and Prakriti, and the relation between Prakriti and Prakriti, the relation between Purusha and Prakriti. You see, in many cases, this is not addressed at all, because, you know, in many of the yoga traditions, the idea is just the experience of the Purusha. So if one becomes one with the Purusha, the Prakriti can fall off, and one knows oneself as the only one there is, or the liberated one. But if one enters in the relation between Purusha and Prakriti, is the enterprise of self-transformation. And if through union with the Purusha one is trying to transform the Prakriti, then the shadow needs to be grappled with. And it can be grappled with either through a process by which the Purusha is extended into the shadow, or through the offering of the shadow to a transcendent outside of one, an extra cosmic transcendent that takes the shadow back and transforms it in that sense.
And I'm finding that
actually this this resistance, or I mean, I'm just thinking aloud. I mean, can we take it as just like, for example, in matter, right? Like it has a resistance, inertia, to remain, to maintain its separateness, because that's how it can maintain its existence. I mean, as a material form or an object. So that resistance is sort of a way to survive for a material object. And similar thing for this principle of separateness, principle of having, you know, separate bodies and things like that. It's a cosmic principle as well as, which is also, I mean, that principle which is also realized in each and every tiny object or any kind of formation, like human being probably is the most comprehensive because it has many things integrated in it. So it's can you look at it as a way to survive without being conscious, and that kind of resistance, because it's resisting because it doesn't know that it's completely secure, meaning it feels insecure, and that is why it resists both at the cosmic level as well as in the at the individual level. Like I mean, a little bit I'm trying to clarify. For example, I have felt, I mean, that's personal, you know, interpretation, you may say, that if I said or somebody said something which sort of confronts some kind of social, you know, convenient, you know, sort of rules or things which is holding the society together as we see it today. If you say something which goes sort of against it, it immediately revolts without really knowing that I'm revolting. It's sort of either rejects it altogether or tries to, you know, mock it or something it does. It feels like it's as if it is insecure, and it immediately knew that I have to protect myself in the sense the rule of being separate.
Okay, I got what you're saying. That problem of insecurity is not the shadow. The problem of insecurity is the ignorance. Ignorance is insecure because it doesn't know. It's not conscious enough. The shadow willfully distorts. That's the difference. The shadow is the basis of evil. It exists because there is a certain will to remain unconscious, and that will exercises itself. It's a conscious exercise of the power to remain unconscious. The insecurity may come purely out of lack of knowledge. It may come out of the fact that there is a certain kind of ignorance at work. But there is more than ignorance. There is falsehood. And the shadow is of the falsehood. Now, the falsehood also exists at all these levels. It exists at the material level. This is the reason why it is not necessary to remain unconscious for matter to exist, separate or discrete, or have its discrete existence. One can conceive of a conscious, discrete matter. Similarly, what we call the shadow more properly emerges at the level of the vital. The vital is more, that's why, you know, even in things like Savitri, you know, the whole notion of the world of falsehood is connected to the vital. The vital is where this will becomes, the will to remain unconscious becomes conscious, you may say. So it generates itself as evil. And that kind of compromise is also present in each of us at some sort of quasi-conscious level. So that is what the shadow is.
and Debashish.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So it's basically, it's the vital, which is more than just, you know, this formation and principles of material inertia.
Yeah, it's at the vital level, but it is also at the level of material inertia. There is something there which is not just inertia. There is something which is, I mean, let's not get into it because that's, you know, I won't be able to say much more about that. But in the metaphysics of Sri Aurobindo, there is falsehood even in matter. That falsehood becomes active in life at the level of the vital.
Yeah, just, I don't want to extend it any further. I mean, that then inertia is also a force, which is basically that resistance force. I mean, if I may, just.
Yeah, it is.
I was just going to say that I'm looking at this issue of the shadow. I've been thinking about it a lot because, you know, I think in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, we're talking about the fact that the divine can transform. And, it's in Jungian thought, it's more of a, becoming aware of and integrating. There is a somewhat of a transformation. But I think it's, there's a transformation in the sense of becoming more aware of it and becoming more whole. And like I say, I'm still studying this, but with the with Aurobindo and what we're talking about here, there is a what would Aurobindo call the shadow? Would he, you know, so I just wanted to put those two things out there. That I think that there's more of a transformation, a supplemental transformation.
Yeah, I agree. I agree exactly with what you said in that, in the Jungian sense, it is a becoming more integrated with the acceptance of the shadow. While in Sri Aurobindo's case, as you can see, it is premised, his whole philosophy is premised on the divine life, which means that the individual can become perfect or become divine. And that implies that there is a transformation of the shadow which removes it completely and makes one completely conscious, ultimately down to the physical. And that is what the whole notion of immortality is about. But that's not something that Jung would accept. I don't think he would envisage that as a possibility, though he may envisage that as a kind of internal, you know, the whole alchemic process of transformation is something that he could envisage as a certain kind of partial transformation. But I don't think he would think of it as something that would completely transform the individual down to the body becoming immortal, becoming divine in that sense.
Yes, I'm looking at post-Jungians to see if, you know, if they're leaning, if some of them are leaning more towards this direction. But I personally am very interested in looking at this nexus and of Aurobindo and Jung and individuation and this idea of the supplemental transformation and finding some areas where there could be harmony, more and more harmony and perhaps some future synthesis. And I'm particularly attracted to looking at that question, this question.
Sure.
I'm going to offer that, to me, I remain deeply inspired by the beginning of the life divine and the notion of the human aspiration as that which moves us certainly beyond the current constellation of conditions and events and their own, how should we call it, unhappy consciousness, its own irresoluteness. And that there's a certain aspiration to really move toward the divine life. Takes, maybe I would phrase it in a certain sense of tapasya with the shadow, that the shadow is providing this necessary friction that also is a heating of the material in an alchemical sense. It's a heating, and perhaps there's something. I'm just going to attempt to say this. If one attempts to move in the Jungian universe, it's held by this tension of opposites and balance. So if one attempts to become lighter, one carries again this darker shadow. The element that I see in advanced societies is integration in the divine forms, and I'm going to and perhaps hazard this at the risk of my lack of knowledge, but that in advanced or highly spiritual societies you see very dark divinities because they're owning the psychopathic elements of human nature. Those parts are reappropriating and being offered to the divine in a certain way so that it carries it. And the human beings, in a sense, are freed to remain in the better part of the choice, trying to be good people. That's going a long way, and I apologize for perhaps having gone too far into this question. But thank you so much, Debashish, for these incredible responses.
And Debashish, let me just add to that and say, and I know that Sri Aurobindo and the mother were holding a tremendous amount of that shadow during World War II, and likely during their whole time, of course, holding the balance for the whole world. So I can only venture to guess what Sri Aurobindo saw on inner planes and felt.
Yeah, you see, this problem of the shadow is a very major one in Sri Aurobindo's work and his philosophy and his yoga, both at the individual and the cosmic level. And the kind of dividing line between the two is blurred. There's a way in which the cosmic and the individual sort of are constantly in relation and feed into each other. But also the dividing line between the human and the divine is blurred. There isn't a divine to which we offer things which is not ourselves at some point and at some level. And there are two ways. That's exactly where, you know, the whole notion of offering something to the divine goes at the same time as being the divine, you know, which he's talking about here. There are these two dynamics. And both these dynamics are present in Sri Aurobindo. You have to have both these dynamics at one level become divine, become the divine, the only divine there is, and at the other level offer to the divine. And, you know, you find this both in Sri Aurobindo and the mother. And in a sense, this is the relationship between Purusha and Prakriti. This is ultimately the relationship between that which is always the one, and that which is, I think, as Justin said very beautifully, in a relationship which is heated by the falsehood, by the shadow.
As you were saying that at the vital level, this shadow or dark forces. Similarly, I'm thinking that, of course, I mean, this also, I don't exactly know where in Life Divine these things are referred to, that, you know, that the mental principle level, like, you know, fixing concentration at some point and thinking of that as self and everything else around it as not self, this division, I mean, mind things as real, and I mean, so basically this division or differentiation, rather, this differentiation and the unity or the oneness, these two together at the mental level, they're contradictory. It's a paradox. to which basically mind or mental principle doesn't have the key. And that Shravinda refers to as that lid, which ultimately, separates us from that knowledge. So that also is the ultimate, gatekeeper. I mean, if you think of the mind instead of the vital, probably the gatekeepers are these shadows and stuff. Do you kind of comment on that?
Yeah, actually, you're very right. I mean, the shadow does not belong only to the vital. I didn't say that, nor does Sri Aurobindo say that. It becomes active at the vital level. It is very much present in the mind. That's why the divisions between Rakshasas and Asuras are really the beings of the vital and the beings of the mental, both elements of the shadow, that's the hostile beings that belong to the two different realms. But it begins to become active at the vital level. That's what I said.
So I'm saying, can you comment on that mind, that gatekeeper, what I was talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. That is the overmind, the mental ego, and I think that relates also to us in a sense to what Justin was saying, in that the largest asuras are in the overmind, because indeed the individual becomes fully itself and yet retains its separateness. It knows its oneness but retains its separateness and cannot merge with the one until it crosses that level, that over mental lid that you're talking about. So in a sense, that is at the prakritic level, all that is happening at the prakritic level, the level of mind, life and matter, but not at the Purusha's level. And at that level, that there is the shadow all the way up, and it's beginning with the overmind. That's where it begins.
Okay, so basically, now it clarifies. So this, the principle of division and giving full reality to that is actually the shadow that you're talking about.
Not only the principle of division and giving full reality, which can exist in the truth. That is why there can be a supramental manifestation which is differentiated. It is the existence of separation with the will to remain separate. That is the essence of the shadow.
Yeah, what I meant by giving it full reality, meaning one is not real, only the division is real. That's what I mean.
Yeah. Giving it full freedom, you could say.
There is that.
Yeah.
It's 9:15, so I was thinking that we can continue the conversation next time and stop
yeah,
here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we'll continue next time, and I'll put up the recording soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Debashish.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Debashish.
Thank you, Debashish.
Thank you.